Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Richard Cordray is stepping down from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's an agency he helped bring to life amid the ashes of the Great Recession and the financial crisis of 2008. His controversial reign over the Bureau ends at the end of November. What happens next to both the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and Cordray's political career has folks talking inside and outside the Beltway, most particularly in his home state of Ohio. It's all national politics this hour with veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Ken joins the show the third Thursday of the month, so mark your calendars. Welcome back, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
Richard Cordray's departure gives the Trump administration an opportunity to take over this watchdog agency that Republicans don't like.
Well, that's true, and it does give them an opportunity. And if you think of the two people who have held the job so far, and that includes Richard Cordray and Elizabeth Warren, both of them have been in thorns in the conservatives and the Republican sides. It does. His departure may open up to a renewal of his political fortunes in Ohio, but as you say, it does give the president somebody on his side to head up that bureau.
Could they didn't want to, I mean, the president could have fired him by now, right?
You know something, I'm surprised they haven't. And they could have fired him. They could have fired, actually, when they got rid of Elizabeth Warren, she says, okay, I'll just run for the Senate in Massachusetts. And she defeated Scott Brown. Mm-hmm. So it backfired on the Republicans then. I just think maybe they thought that he might just go away, or they would keep that bureau kind of like powerless. They could have fired him. They didn't. I think the administration seems to be more focused on getting more and more judges appointed and confirmed to the federal benches. And on that regard, mm-hmm. they're doing just fine. Thank you very much.
Yeah, they're the latest very young, very inexperienced lawyer, right?
Well, you know, there's a new somebody who just confirmed or at least went through the confirmation process in the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is somebody who's never tried a case. This is for a federal judgeship, a lifetime judgeship, never tried a case, was unanimously rejected as unqualified by the American Bar Association. And I guess that must be a badge of honor for some Republicans mm-hmm. on the Judiciary Committee, because they say the ABA is liberal. And, you know, I mean, we've heard that against, you know, we've heard about the ABA being liberal going back to Nixon's mm-hmm. time, and Haynesworth and Carswell, his nominees for the Supreme Court in 1969 and 1970. So, I mean, it's a familiar Republican refrain, but just the thought of them being unanimously regarded as not qualified and then still wind up on the bench does tell you a lot of what's going on in today's politics.
It's something that the president's bragged about recently, how fast his court appointees are moving along.
Well, you know something, that is something you talk about, that the Republicans haven't accomplished much in the year since President Trump's election and the 11 months since he's been sworn in. And there's truth to that. A lot of things have just not passed. The Republicans have still not repealed or replaced the Affordable Care Act, which they promised to do immediately. They're still having problems with taxes. But on the judiciary, they are going all out. I mean, Mitch McConnell, whatever you think about his relationship or lack of same with President Trump, mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell and the Republicans are doing a masterful job of getting Trump appointees confirmed to the federal courts in a faster rate than many other previous presidents. And the fact that the Democrats and the Republicans as well have gotten rid of the filibuster when it comes to these nominations, mm-hmm. it just means that these nominees could sail through with a majority. And that's why, of course, the 2018 elections are so important.
Lifetime appointments, by the way, and they're unimpeachable. I mean, unless there's some malfeasance, they're.
Oh, right. I mean, yeah. I think you could count on one hand those maybe. Well, even on a small hand, those federal judges who have been removed from office in the past, I don't know, 30, 40 years. Mm-hmm. It has to be some kind of impeachable offense, some kind of corruption for the most part. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people are there for life.
And the guy that he had, the most recent, the very inexperienced one that the American Bar Association has unanimously opposed for the appointment, he is known for his very right-wing views on issues.
Well, that's true. And then look, I mean, in fairness to Trump and the Republicans, this uh-huh. is what they promised. They
right.
promised after
Absolutely.
8 years of Barack Obama, that they would have a much more conservative viewpoint towards towards all these issues. And so it's not that the fact that the ideology is conservative or right wing, that is not a surprise. It's the lack of qualifications. But as you point out, Trump likes the fact that this is not politics as usual. This is not the establishment's choice for nominees. These are just conservatives, you know, who live out, live in the country and have these views that coincide with what the president is trying to propose.
My guest is political junkie Ken Rudin. He's a veteran political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You have a question or comment for Ken, you can talk to him. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You can also post a question or comment on our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. And Ben Jam did. Ken, he says, will you be collecting Trump campaign buttons or have they already found their way to the recycling? There's a wink emoji there. But, were there a lot of Trump buttons out there?
Well, I mean, in the old days, I love how talking how old I am. But in the old days, you can walk into a headquarters and just fill your pockets with campaign buttons, right. Republican or Democrat. Matter of fact, there was one year, which I'm not proud of, but I think I volunteered for 27 different presidential candidates so I can get all the buttons.
Oh, my God.
which is very, 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 very magnanimous of me.
Yeah, yeah.
But now, I mean, when you think of Trump buttons, this is something called the Trump store, and you have to purchase them from them. And the same with Obama, you had to purchase them from the headquarters or the vendors or the jobbers who would put them out. It's not like the old days, but and what is like the old days, right?
Exactly.
But anyway, the point is that the buttons are, you know, I've never had a caring whether it's a D or an R, a liberal or conservative, as I think Thomas Jefferson once said, a button is a button. I believe he said that. He may not have said that, but I've said that.
What's the mood in Washington right now? What is the mood in Washington right now? We just hit the year anniversary of the election.
The election.
Of Donald
Trump.
Well,
the mood is, you know, depending on who you ask. Mm-hmm. If you ask, if you know, there is still a good sizable amount of Trump supporters who still see him as the person who has changed American politics for the better. They saw that under Obama, for better or worse, jobs were being shipped overseas. People were losing their jobs. There was a culture war in the country that was not going their way. Donald Trump, for all his faults, and you know I could list his faults from, you know, going on from here to doomsday, but the point is that he brought a change that a lot of conservatives want. Of course, there are liberals and Democrats, and not too small amount of Republicans who say this is just not what politics should be about, that there's an ugliness and an intolerance that's out there that is just really destroying any kind of comity. And not that there was any kind of going along or good relationships between the two parties, but now it's poison. Now it's us against them. Now it's the media is the enemy of the American people. And so it's not what anybody's seen before. Now, Donald Trump promised that you'll this is something you've never seen before. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not only Democrats and liberals and the media who are just seem to be so despondent. You see more and more Republicans like Jeff Flake of Arizona and Bob Corker of Tennessee and others who say that this is just not the way politics should be conducted.
The president just returned from 12 days in Asia. He's calling it a big success. But it's not clear that there were any particular policy changes. And he did manage to squeak out a tweet in China, of all places, where he isn't supposed to be able to do that, but trashing Kim Jong-un again of North Korea.
Well, yes. Here's the thing. I mean, this was ostensibly designed, this 12-day Asia trip was ostensibly designed to show President Trump as a leader and somebody who would just bring America back to the forefront, as Trump has been saying that he will do from the beginning. And so in the beginning, he met with the leaders of South Korea and Japan and China, and it was seemingly successful. He is working together to try to form a coalition to oppose North Korea, more and more sanctions, although I can't imagine any what any more sanctions will do, mm-hmm. considering the fact that the irrationality that's coming out of Pyongyang is not stopped with all these sanctions. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, in the next breath, the president will talk about, you know, still talk about Hillary Clinton. I'm sorry, crooked Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. He'll talk about how the people who are talking about Russian meddling are dupes and fools. He will criticize the former heads of the U.S. intelligence agencies, like James Clapper, for example. He'll say that they're just hacks, partisan hacks. So, you know, it's interesting. He'll torment our allies. He'll rupture relations with our allies, given how he feels about trade deals and climate deals. But he'll only say good things about President Putin. He'll say good things about thugs like Philippine President Duterte, whose administration has killed thousands in this anti-drug campaign that they're doing. And it's just it's a priority that most people who have watched politics for as long as anybody has never seen before.
He does spend a lot more time. It's kind of ironic. He spends a lot more time with the media, even though he trashes it more than any president I can remember.
Oh, he well, first of all,
it's
a
love-hate relationship, right?
Exactly. There's no shortage of historical indicators that show presidents who don't get along with the media. Mm-hmm. I mean, not only Richard Nixon with his enemies list, but Barack Obama had fights with the media for years, you know, with subpoenaing reporters' records and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the fact that fake news and at the same time he talks about the fake news and the dishonest news and the failing New York Times and, you know, the dishonest CNN and all that. He said he was forced to watch CNN in China because I think that's all he could watch or something. I don't know anybody who could be forced to watch CNN. Believe me, if my choice was watching Wolf Blitzer or hiding under a bed, I would hide under the bed in a second. I mean, there's no question I could not be forced to do that. But at the same time, you're absolutely right. He hungers for this to be liked and to be appreciated. And if he can find a random quote in a random Washington Post or New York Times article that says he did some good things, I mean, you know, like, for example, on his trip to Asia, he will highlight that mm-hmm. in his speech to the in the White House, as he did yesterday.
We're talking politics with the political junkie, Ken Rudin, a veteran political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Again, we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll continue our conversation, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. President Trump is set to rally House Republicans today before they vote on a sweeping tax overhaul aimed at cutting taxes for corporations permanently and individuals temporarily. It's one of two GOP tax plans lawmakers are working on. The Senate has proposed its own bill. Still with us, veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The tax overhaul still faces obstacles. Republicans must align the legislation that is expected to pass the House with a bill working its way through the Senate Finance Committee this week. But all things being equal, this is a very, very, once again, a very quick take on something that in past administrations and in past sessions has taken years.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's funny that, you know, that the Republicans want this on President Trump's desk yesterday. I mean, it's not going to happen that soon, mm-hmm. although they are talking about having it on his desk by Christmas. But you're right. The last time there was a tax overhaul like this was during the Reagan administration in 1986. And that took 11 months of hearings and writings and, you know, drafts and things like that. And here they're almost, I mean, the language didn't even exist until a week or so ago. And now they want to rush it on the president's desk by by Christmas. And yes, the Republicans are desperate, as we said, they're desperate for a victory. They're still trying to repeal and replace Obamacare, and that hasn't happened yet, even though they've had at least three tries. And most of the problem is coming from not the House, which is voting today on the tax bill, but the Senate, because you have just a few. I mean, look, it's a 52-48 Republican majority in the Senate, and if you lose three Republicans, you know, you lose the control of the bill. And as we saw in the health care bill, it was Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins and John McCain who voted no, that killed it several times. And that may be similar opposition with the tax bill, with all the problems going on there. Mm-hmm. We saw Ron Johnson, the conservative Republican from Wisconsin, yesterday saying that he could not support it because mm-hmm. basically the bill as written now in the Senate supports corporations over small businesses. And I mean, whether that opposition holds up or not, we always see Rand Paul, for example, or Ted Cruz saying, I'm going to oppose something that the Trump administration supports. And then ultimately they crumble. Mm-hmm. But look, first things first, they vote in the House today. And, you know, it should pass. The Republicans have a pretty much, I think, they could afford to lose no more than 22 Republican votes, assuming all Democrats vote against it. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of deductions that a lot of taxpayers are used to having that are being taken away in this bill.
Right. I mean, the optics of some of these things just don't. They don't make sense if they're trying to sell this to the rank and file Republican voter out there, particularly. But they hurt blue states worse than red states because that's where, for instance, the mortgage interest deduction is going to hit hardest in the East Coast and on the West Coast, where that's there are more middle class people that have higher appraised homes.
That's absolutely right. In many red states around the country, the middle class will get a tax cut, and it will be beneficial to middle class tax payers around the country. But in states, as you point out correctly, in states like New York and New Jersey with very high income taxes and property taxes, the elimination of the deductions for the state and local taxes, the deductions for the interest rates, losing that, eliminating that deduction as well, eliminating the deduction for medical expenses. You already have five Republicans from New York State and three from New Jersey already promising to vote no. That's eight right there.
Right.
You have at least seven Republicans in California who have been elected in Hillary Clinton winning districts. And even conservative Republicans are saying, I have not been elected to Congress so I could turn my backs on these middle class constituents of mine. But again, if the defections are fewer than 22, the Republicans will get their victory. They'll get their victory, as they did with health care in the House. And then once again, it goes up to the Senate, where there are, you know, I mean, again, you can't lose more than two. Mm-hmm. And if Susan Collins and John McCain and Ron
Lisa
Johnson,
Murkowski, yeah.
Lisa Murkowski's interesting because even though she's concerned about there's now an attachment in the Senate that would get rid of the individual mandate regarding Obamacare. And while that's very important to her, it's also being attached to drilling in the Arctic, you know, the ANWR drilling in the Arctic. That is a big thing for Lisa Murkowski. So she may vote yes on it. But then you also have these new Trump opponents like Jeff Flake and Bob Corker, who are conservatives, but they just say, look, you know, this Senate tax cut will increase the deficit by $1.5 trillion over 10 years, and I didn't come to Washington to increase the deficit. So this is hardly a done deal.
Hardly a done deal, but we'll know within a couple weeks.
We will. But, look, we the Republicans said on the first day we're going to repeal and replace. And it took them, right. It's still taking them 11 months and it hasn't happened yet. So just because there is an artificial deadline of Christmas to get this done, that doesn't mean that they can't go through some failures. I mean, we saw the Senate fail three times to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. And they're still in this tax bill, still trying to do it one more time. It's like Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. You think she's finished, but she keeps coming out of that bathtub.
Now,
you know.
Who could forget that seat?
No, I can't. No.
But what about the issue of the Obamacare mandate and attaching that to this measure? Is that an effort to just get votes, or is that an effort to show the voters again that they're trying to kill off what is considered the most unpopular aspect of it, which, by the way, is the most integral aspect of it, because without that, Obamacare fails.
Exactly. And that's a very good point, and that's a very good question. And it's unanswerable, whether it's a sop to their support of saying, once again, we're trying to do what we promised, getting rid of that hated Obamacare. But at the same time, you lose, you know, as you say, I mean, 13 million Americans may be without health care, without affordable health care. Mm-hmm. If you get rid of the mandate, they'll be without the health care. And you lose the people like the Susan Collinses and the perhaps others in the Senate as well. So it's a risky thing. I mean, you know, the thing is, Obamacare was unpopular in this country until the Republicans tried to come up with an alternative. And then suddenly they said, well, wait a second, this may be the best thing we got. And that's what it's proven. So even though polls showed for the longest time that the Affordable Care Act was not popular, had a lot of problems that could be resolved and hopefully could be resolved. Remember in the Bernie Sanders versus Hillary Clinton battles, mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders said, look, there are problems and we need to fix it. But once the Republicans came up with their idea, and which ultimately would throw so many millions off health care, people started saying, "Oh, I like that Obamacare after all."
So,
you know, I don't know what the goal, ultimate goal is.
As I mentioned, the president's supposed to be rallying Republicans in the House, which, as you pointed out, it's not really an issue there. But is this what he wants? Is it clear that what they're doing with this legislation is what the president wants, or does he want to do anything, and we'll blame them again if they fail?
Well, look, there are valid criticisms of the president, and sometimes it's hyperbole, but my gut tells me that he has never been in the weeds of the details. He mm-hmm. basically didn't know a lot of the language that was in the health care bills that were proposed, and I doubt that I think he just wants a victory, mm-hmm. and I think he just says, we are winning. Remember when he was running for election, he said, we're going to have so much winning, you're going to get tired of all this winning. Well, they haven't been winning too much lately, except for the judiciary, and so he wants a victory. He wants to say, he wants the Republicans to go to the voters in 2018 said, here's what we accomplished. We gave the middle class a tax cut and tax fairness. Whether that's portrayed as fairness by the Democrats and the media are two different things. But right now, I think he's just hungry for a victory.
And I guess I would imagine so is the House and the Senate.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I still suspect that there are Republicans, you know, good conscience Republicans who say that, you know, a victory is nice, but a victory for the right reasons is why we are sent to Washington. And if it's a bad bill that hurts a lot of millions of people, then I don't want to be a part of it. And for many people, this has nothing to do with being a D or an R. It's just trying to do the right thing. You don't see that too often on Capitol Hill, but when you do, it sticks out and you remember it.
How much do you think people are going to understand that the corporate tax cuts would be permanent and the individual tax cuts would not be?
Well, the fact that you just said it and the fact that people are saying it, I think people will know that. I mean, of course, we don't know the actual final language in what the Senate bill is right now. But as you point out, that the individual tax cuts in the Senate bill are set to expire in the year 2025, whereas the corporate tax cuts, moving it from 35% to 20%, is permanent. Now Republicans can say, well, if the Democrats want the individual tax cuts permanent, you know, God bless, we'll consider that as well. So, but I mean, if it is successfully portrayed by Democrats as helping the rich at the expense of the middle class, helping the corporations at the expense of small businesses, then the Republicans have a serious political issue on its hands mm-hmm. for 2018 and beyond.
And you use the phrase portrayed successfully by the Democrats. They haven't been very good at portraying much of anything successfully.
No, they haven't. And, you know, something we always talk about, how the Republicans are eating their own, and, you know, the Mitch McConnell establishment wing of the party versus the Steve Bannon, you know, alternative wing of the Republican Party. But the Democrats are not doing so well either. They don't know whether to you know, compromise with the president or go all out against him. When Dianne Feinstein, the veteran senator from California, announced that she will seek another term at the age of 84 next year, there are a lot of progressive, I don't know how, but a lot is, but there are a bunch of progressive Democrats who said that she is too willing to cooperate with Trump and the Republicans. We need somebody, given all the anger that's in our base, we need fighters, not accommodators. So the Democrats are fighting among themselves as well.
Exactly. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is a veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page. Check out the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Post a question or comment there. Ken, I want to move on to kind of the, you know, the elephant in the corner the past few weeks when it comes to Washington, D.C., and that is the sexual harassment. Let's start with the question of Senate candidate Roy Moore of Alabama. He's denied a growing bevy of allegations of sexual assault. A fifth woman this week accused him of assaulting her when she was 16. Beverly Young Nelson accused Moore of groping and assaulting her in his car.
At some point he gave up. And he then looked at me and he told me, he said, "You're just a child." And he said, "I am the district attorney of Etowah County. And if you tell anyone about this, no one will ever believe you."
Leaders of the National Republican Party have called on Moore to end his campaign and threatened to expel him from the Senate should he win the December 12th special election against Democrat Doug Jones. Still with us, veteran, Ken Rudin, what about that? What about Moore? The president hasn't said a word about it yet, and it looks like he's not going to walk away.
Well, let's say one thing up front. I mean, with all the talk about sexual harassment that's in the news, the Harvey Weinsteins of the world and all those stories, sexual predators of young children is a different issue completely. I mean, I'm not dismissing, of course, harassment or sexual discrimination in the workplace, but when you prey on 16-year-old girls, 14-year-old girls, that's something beyond the pale. So let's get that straight right away. Roy Moore is just remarkable. I mean, he's running a pro-God, pro-family campaign, trying to win support among evangelical Christians in Alabama, which is 50% of the vote in Alabama, saying that, you know, that this is, I am basically doing God's work. And you have all these women, you have, I think the number is up to 9 now, who have come forward and said that he did something inappropriate, either attempted rape or molestation or something, or some harassment when they were teenagers. That is beyond the pale. It is interesting to me that we have not heard this before. And I say this because he's run for office many times. He was twice elected Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, although he was removed both times for a little pesky little thing like violating the Constitution. But he also ran for governor twice, and it never came up.
But we're in another age when it comes to these kind of things.
Well, you know something, right, exactly. I think the onus should not be on women to say, "Why didn't you come forward?" The onus is now on that men, these people who have committed these atrocities, should not be able to get away with it. And there are so many men in Hollywood and Washington and in politics who have gotten away with it for so many years that women are finally starting to say, like, you know, the consequences be damned, I'm coming forward. Let me just add something. I know this was not part of, I mean, I don't know what if we had an agenda or anything, but now there are more and more Democrats who are asking questions about how they supported Bill Clinton. I am not necessarily equating Bill Clinton with Donald Trump, or certainly not Roy Moore, but there have been accusations against Bill Clinton, not the Monica Lewinsky case, but the Paula Joneses and the Juanita Brodericks and people like that, and the Kathleen Willies, who said that, I mean, he was accused of rape. He was accused of exposing himself. So, and there are a lot of Democrats who blamed women back in 1992 instead of Bill Clinton. And I think there are more and more liberals or whatever, or Democrats who are starting to come to terms with maybe we were wrong in dismissing these women against Bill Clinton. Again, I'm going back several decades here, but I think if we're going to go on and talk about the Harvey Weinsteins and the mm-hmm. Kevin Spaceys of the world, and certainly Donald Trump with Access Hollywood, mm-hmm. Nobody should be excluded, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican.
Well, yeah, I mean, no one's going to have the corner on this market because it seems like a lot more is being touched upon with Republicans, but they're also in power right now, and they have majorities in both of the chambers. So that, and I'm not to mention, you know, the executive branch. So that's natural, but eventually it'll start hitting the fan with Democrats as well.
No, I think that's true. But anyway, back to Alabama, yeah. though. I mean, Alabama has not elected a Democrat to the Senate since 1992. It is over. Donald Trump won the state by 28 points. Hillary Clinton was a disaster for the Democrats in 2016, as she was in most of the South. The only Southern state she carried was Virginia, by the way. I mean, that was the only one she carried. And Roy Moore defeated Donald Trump's choice for the Senate, the guy who was appointed to the Senate after Jeff Sessions left it. You're looking at all the battering that Jeff Sessions is getting on Capitol Hill for remembering or not remembering what meetings he may or may not have had with Russians. Yeah. You wonder if he wishes he was still in that Senate seat. And there are some Republicans who actually wish that he was, too. They're talking about maybe even a write-in candidate for Jeff Sessions, which, of course, would be a win-win for President Trump. Get Sessions out of there. You know, he recused himself. I mean, I think President Trump thinks that Jeff Sessions is responsible for Robert Mueller, because once Sessions recused himself from the Russian investigation, mm-hmm. they had to come up with a special counsel, and that was Robert Mueller.
Well,
so
we have an email from Debbie, and she says if Jeff Sessions is elected to the Senate as a write-in instead of Roy Moore, and we have a new attorney general, would that end the Mueller investigation? It wouldn't necessarily end it, would it?
Oh, God, no. Oh, no. Yeah. There are so many things. I mean, look, you know, people say, why? Well, I mean, I don't mean, please. I mean, please, God, let it go on. There are so many facts. I was just trying to use Roy Moore talk.
Yeah.
But I thought I'd bring God into every conversation.
Yeah.
But look, there's so many facets to the Mueller investigation, the indictments of Paul Manafort and his top aide, and the guilty plea of George Papadopoulos. I mean, that's just the beginning. And people say, well, why is it going on so long? And I always say, well, remember, between the Watergate break-in and the Nixon resignation, that was 2 years.
Exactly.
And Robert Mueller only started in, what, May or June?
Yeah, this has been nothing. I mean, frankly, I can't believe how fast it's moving. We're going to return to our conversation. We're going to drill down a little bit deeper on the sexual harassment issues in Washington and in the state houses. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment, want to talk to Ken Rudin, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Getting back to the Roy Moore candidacy, national Republicans, that is almost everyone but the president, have called out on Moore to end his run for the Senate, but state Republicans still back him. Why the discord in the party?
Well, I think it's pretty clear. On my Political Junkie program this week, I talked to Bill Stewart, who's a professor emeritus at the University of Alabama, and he said that people in Alabama resent interference from Washington. When Mitch McConnell came to Alabama, or at least campaigned hard for Luther Strange in the primary a few months ago, Republicans in Alabama resented that. They resented even Donald Trump backed Luther Strange. They said, no, we'll make the choice, and that's one of the reasons they picked Roy Moore. So I think there's always been a disconnect between what Washington wants and what Alabama Republicans want. But it's true, but to his credit, I mean, Mitch McConnell, when he was the head of the Senate Ethics Committee in the mid-1990s, he did everything he could to get Bob Packwood, the Oregon Republican, out of the Senate for all those sexual harassment allegations, and there were many of them. And apparently, people knew this for years, but McConnell was very aggressive, and they probably would have expelled him had Packwood not resigned in 1995. So he's doing the same thing with Roy Moore. He says he is unfit to serve in the Senate. There's no place for him. He should get out. Knowing Roy Moore, I mean, you know, as well as anybody does, it seems like he is not the kind of guy who would bow to pressure, certainly from Washington, and he just feels that he has a shot, and he does have a shot. It's an overwhelmingly Republican state. There are a lot of people who say that, well, yes, he may have made some mistakes in the past, but I'm not going to put a liberal Democrat in the Senate. And I mean, I can't remember the last time, or forget about when Alabama had Democrats in the Senate. A liberal Democrat goes back decades. I mean, you're just back when there was no Republican Party, there may have been some liberals. But anyway, the point is that there was just a disconnect between what Washington Republicans have to say and what Alabama Republicans have to say. And right now, I don't know who's going to win. I mean, the polls are all over the place, but I know it'll shock a lot of people if he wins, but you know, stranger things have happened, shall we say.
The latest polls have Moore 12 points behind his Democratic opponent, but the polls apparently are all over the place. According to an Alabama Public Radio reporter this morning.
Right. And you know something, and we've seen polls. Look, the day of the 2016 election, polls had Hillary Clinton winning. And this is the day, and we still have until December 12th for the Alabama election. So polls are not being, I mean, and we saw last week, excuse me, in Virginia, that everybody thought that the Republicans were creeping up, getting much closer in the race for governor of Virginia. Ed Gillespie was running on Trump kind of campaign issues about culture and race and immigration, and he was gaining and gaining and gaining, and Democrats were nervous. And as it turned out, Democrats won it by 9 points. So, I mean, I don't want to criticize the polling industry, but they have not been as reliable as they had been in the past. And I'd ignore the polls. And I think the best thing to do is just go down there. Not that you can go down there, just go down there and talk to people. But you're getting different kind of opinions from everybody. And, you know, the Democrats in Washington, basically all they can do is just sit back. They're not going to say Doug Jones, they're not going to send in Nancy Pelosi to Alabama and say, we need Doug Jones in the Senate. All they can do is send money and just hope for the best. But right now, you know, it's really a toss-up who wins.
Facebook message from Dell. If Moore stays in and wins, will he weigh down the GOP brand elsewhere in the country as midterms draw near?
Yes, he absolutely would. And that's why, I mean, I'm convinced, well, I mean, as I'm convinced about anything, but I'm convinced that if he does win, they will seat him. I mean, I remember, first of all, I remember back in the 1960s when Adam Clayton Powell, the controversial Democrat from New York, from Harlem, who was a big power he was the chairman of the House Labor Committee. He was reelected and the House refused to seat him. And they went to the Supreme Court and they said, look, the voters win, you seat him. But I suspect that if Roy Moore wins, they'll seat him, but then they'll vote to expel him. And if they do expel him, the governor of Alabama, who's a Republican, Kay Ivey, would appoint a non-sexual abuser, one would think, to the Senate to replace him, which would be a win-win situation for the Republicans. So I think he could win, but if he does win, there's no way that McConnell allows him and the Republicans allow him to stay in the Senate.
Why do you think the president hasn't weighed in on this?
Well, the president has also, first of all, I mean, it's very interesting. He'll say that, well, I haven't been really following it that well, but of course he'll talk about the basketball players in China and crooked Hillary Clinton and the uranium deal she made with the Russians. I mean, you know, the things that he sees on Breitbart News, suddenly he wants to tweet about, but Roy Moore, he doesn't know enough about. Look, we know the history of Donald Trump. We know that the famous Billy Bush tapes from the bus that was a month or so before the election. He knows that there were accusations against Donald Trump too. He's the last person in the world to weigh in about sexual impropriety. But to her credit, Ivanka Trump, tweeted yesterday. His president's daughter said, "There's a place in hell for people who prey on young women, you know, on girls, on children, on teenagers." And she said that she believes the women. So I thought that was a very interesting thing. For, you know, a lot of people have more hope for Ivanka Trump as trying to moderating the president's behavior. I think that's out. I think that's overblown. I don't think it's real. But in this case, she did step forward.
Everyone knows this is the tip of the iceberg in Congress. There have been several stories written now that talk about there's at least 50 members, at least that many, past and present, recent past and present, that are known problems in Congress when it comes to sexual harassment. What are your expectations, Ken?
Well, you know, we always think that, you know, there'll be a horrific gun crime and suddenly gun laws will change. I mean, that doesn't happen. But I think there is a sea change going on regarding that. I think we see it in Hollywood, and I think we see it in Congress, too. We saw testimony by several members, female members of Congress in the last couple of days, Claire McCaskill, the senator from Missouri, who's up for re-election next year, Jackie Speier, the Democrat from California, talked about when they were staffers on Capitol Hill, they were groped, they were harassed, they were fondled, and I think for years, I mean, I remember Strom Thurmond would never keep his hands to himself when he was in a members-only elevator, and people would, like, chuckle. I mean, the thought of this being amusing is beyond the pale, but, oh, that's Strom Thurmond being Strom Thurmond. Well, I don't think anybody just can get away with this anymore. The fact that they got away with it for so many decades is appalling enough, but I think the more and more women who have spoken up, the more and more, and now Paul Ryan is talking about mandatory sexual harassment training for every member and every staffer in Congress. I don't know if that alone changes it, but I think these first-person stories by the McCaskills of the world, I think, we always talk about the changing of politics as usual. Well, behavior as usual, I think, changes on Capitol Hill.
We have a couple questions. Well, let's see. We have an email from a listener who writes, "As a lifelong Republican, I have become dissatisfied with the quality of candidates that the party selects. It seems we can't get a common sense moderate nominated, let alone elected. The primaries are little more than extremist sycophants and professional money raisers. Why is this so?" We've talked about this before.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, basically the primaries, the Democrats and the Republicans, the more left-wing Democrats participate in the primaries and as well as the more right-wing Republicans, it's hard to get moderates winning anymore. Once upon a part of the reason is the way the congressional lines are redrawn and redistricted, in the fact that there's no reason for these candidates to reach across party lines because it's a solid D or a solid R seat. I mean, in the old days, I mean, Ohio's a perfect example. You used to have congressmen like Chuck Whalen from, I guess he was from Dayton, but I mean, they used to have people like that who were moderates in like 52-48% districts one way or the other, and they had to reach across party lines and compromise. Compromise is now a dirty word. If you're a Republican who's caught compromising, or vice versa, a Democrat caught compromising, they are immediately threatened with a primary challenge. And so I think a lot of the Republicans who are looking at this tax bill and who have looked at the health care bill, not only So they had this balancing act. They wanted to support and defend and represent their constituents, but they also knew that if they crossed Donald Trump, if they voted against the so-called Trump agenda, they would be met by a primary challenge by the right in 2018. So I agree. I agree with the caller. It's not the way it used to be. I think it's really it's not done deals. You know, there's a new book that just came out. Charlie Sykes is a former Wisconsin radio show host, very conservative, I mean, but he's also very anti-Trump and what Trump has done to the conservative party. And there's a new book he has out. It's called How the Right Lost Its Mind. I recommend the book because it's from a conservative point of view saying, you know, it's one thing to be a Tom Steyer liberal or a, you know, any kind of liberal and say that Donald Trump should be impeached. This is a strong argument against Trump by the conservative wing of the Republican Party saying that the GOP has lost its way. It's really worth reading.
Email from Katie in Columbus, hearkening back to the nomination of Talley to the federal court. She says, addressing Ken's comments about judicial nominations, isn't it reasonable for the American Bar Association to reject a judge appointment if the individual has never, that's all caps, tried a case? That doesn't seem to be a political reason, but directly addresses professional competence and experience. Mr. Talley also did not disclose voluntarily that his wife is a lawyer in the Trump administration. In fact, my understanding is that her office is in charge of vetting judicial nominees. Exclamation point. That tells us something about Mr. Talley's ethical standards and those of his wife. It suggests to me that Trump is picking people who will be personally loyal to him.
Well, you know, something that we saw that come up with the James Comey testimony. He said that Trump demanded loyalty. And of course, Comey's response is, my loyalty is to the Constitution. And Jeff Sessions was asked about that, too. But there's a certain kind of experience is important, but I think Donald Trump feels that, look, I was elected president with no political experience. We could have judges who are truly conservative and not have judicial experience as well. There's obviously, Katie makes a good point, and there's far more to the Talley nomination than just saying, well, you know, he's never tried a case before, and that's why the ABA voted him down. I think there are just other things that I think that the things that would be disqualifying in any other time in our history, suddenly the president finds appealing, and suddenly this Republican Congress, Republican majority finds appealing because they just want to erase what Barack Obama tried to do for the past 8 years.
And again, these are lifetime appointments. It doesn't erase
lifetime
just that, but it can go forward and, you know, the control lever is, you know, definitely heavily weighed in their favor. What's happening here? We got the tax legislation, you know, the tax reform. That is an ongoing issue. Sex harassment in Congress, that's an ongoing issue. This Moore campaign, that's December 12th is the election. Do you think that he's going to go through with it, Ken?
Do I think that Rory Moore stays in the race?
Yeah.
I do. I mean, knowing what I've seen of him, he shows, it seems like if you listen to what his lawyers had to say, they're putting the accusers on trial, which is often the case in sexual harassment cases, that it's the women's fault. It's the onus is on women to prove it, not on the men. I do think he stays in it. Again, you know, I don't know what to expect. I think Doug Jones, the Democrat, is doing the right thing by kind of staying quiet.
Right.
He's trying to raise money. He's going on the air by pointing out a lot of Republicans who are backing him. But it's just, you know, it's just it's almost endemic of what may be happening to the Republican Party in 2018, because for all the Mitch McConnells and the Paul Ryans who are saying, you know, this guy is unqualified and would be a disgrace and has no business being the Senate, there are the Steve Bannons of the Republican Party who said, look, I'm sticking by Roy Moore. This is I'm not going to let the Washington Post and Mitch McConnell decide who's going to represent me in the Senate. I'm gonna rely on the people. And so you see, you know, you either see the Jeff Flakes and the Bob Corkers of the world quitting the Senate because either they're not going to win the primary anymore because the primary is so skewed to the right, or you just see other people just going along and not standing up for principles. I mean, remember when, I mean, I don't want to draw parallels to Richard Nixon for the rest of my life, but when at the end of Nixon, it was Republicans like Barry Goldwater and Robert Griffin of Michigan and others who stood up and say, look, the jig is up. There's no more justification for you staying in office. Trump has only been in office for 1 year. And so even though it seems like longer, but it's only 1 year. But if he still breaks away from traditional Republican views, I suspect more and more Republicans will stand up, and we'll see what happens in 2018.
Ken Rudin, thanks as always. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.